And I'm very happy now to welcome Ian Shipsey. He is a particle physicist and professor of physics from Oxford University, and he will be giving a talk tonight titled Bionic Hearing, the Science and the Experience, sponsored by the Santa Fe Alliance for Science. It's at 6 o'clock at the O'Keefe Education Annex. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. You have such an interesting story. You were born with normal hearing, but at the age of 30, you became completely deaf following a medical treatment that saved your life but took away your hearing. In what ways did your life change, and in what ways did it stay on track?
That's a great question. I mean, when I first lost my hearing, the first thing you wonder is how you can communicate to people. I'd just been hired as a professor just before I became ill. And when I lost my hearing for that university, Purdue University, which is in Indiana, there was a big question of how can this guy teach? And they concluded that I probably couldn't. So for a couple of years, I spent time doing research, only research, won some national prizes. Then it was decided that probably some other university might try to steal me. So they wanted to promote me. They thought about that for a while and realized I had no teaching experience. And so they gave me a course to teach that would be very easy. Purdue is the home of astronauts, people like Neil Armstrong, Eugene Cernan, and the first and last men on the moon. So they gave me a course that those kind of people would have had, people that love astronomy and astrophysics in general, and would be easy to teach. So I taught them, and I'd never taught anyone in my life before. So I was absolutely terrified going into class. Said the first thing I said to my students was, I cannot hear you. And a lot of the students looked at each other and thought, what is this? I then told them that the way they'd communicate was writing things down. Turned out that writing things down was the best way to get students to ask questions because they don't have to stand up in front of the class and embarrass themselves. I could read out the question and answer it. At the end of that semester, I won Professor of the Year Award and promotion was taken care of. But that was the big question, was how can you communicate? And what I found was that people want to communicate so much that they find ways around the fact that they couldn't hear. And so for 12 years, I had no hearing, but managed to communicate really well. But it was hard. My daughter was born during that time, and I couldn't hear her voice. But she figured out her daddy was deaf, and she could, if she was thirsty, she would raise a glass to her mouth to indicate she wanted a glass of milk or something like that. So we managed in many ways, but it's not easy for people to live with someone that cannot hear.
Did you and your family learn American Sign Language?
No. The reason for that was very simple. That's a beautiful language, but it's one that people learn often when they're born deaf or in the deaf community. Because I was hearing for most of my life, and the people that I worked with were hearing people, they did not know sign language. And so it would not have been useful for me to have learnt it as a way to work and to teach. And so I didn't.
Now, what was your speech like? I mean, you were teaching lecture classes, but presumably you couldn't hear yourself.
Well, that's a good question. So when you're completely deaf, you can still feel vibrations. And so you know when you're talking. And to some extent, you can modulate your voice because the louder the sound, the more vibration. But it's quite difficult to do so. And so I would sometimes speak a little too softly or a little too loudly. But by and large, I modulated my voice quite well and enunciated well. And so I did lose a little bit of the crispness. But that came back later when I got the implant.
Right, right. Now, what did your sense of the world, of the space around you, change?
To some extent, yeah, because it's a bit like if you're a fish in a fish tank and looking out at the room with all the people doing interesting things. To some extent, the world is passing you by and you feel that you can't really interact with it, at least not without making a lot more effort. It's much harder to have the conversation, harder to meet people. There was also a tendency for people to feel embarrassed talking to a deaf person because we want to communicate in a very clear and effective way. And if the person says to you, I can't hear you, I can't understand, that's an embarrassing thing, both for the person that cannot hear and the person that can. And so there was a tendency for people to walk down the corridor in the physics building, see me coming the other way, wave, and then suddenly turn right or left. And I used to attribute that to the simply that the building was very big. And then, as soon as I got my hearing back, there was a long line of professors at my door wanting to talk to me for the first time because now I could hear. So I learned that, yes, there was a bit of avoidance.
Very interesting. Well, I mean, how did you communicate with your wife? You spoke to her, but how did she speak to you?
So my wife's Italian, and Italians, when they're children at school, learn how to spell with a sign language.
Really?
language?
It's very different to American Sign Language. It's not a real language. It's really just taking the letters of our alphabet and spelling words. And she was really good and really fast at it. And so that's how she would communicate to me. And I could lip read. I learned to lip read immediately I lost my hearing. And I learned that at the Manhattan Ear, Eye and Throat Hospital. That was very helpful. Lip reading is approximate. There are times when the shape of a word on the lips could be the same for two completely different words.
Right.
So it's approximate. But you can narrow things down knowing the context and so on. And so occasionally I'd get things way wrong. But by and large, I did quite well lip reading as well. As long as you were not too far from me and I was not too far from you, it could work.
Now, and because you were a physicist, presumably, I mean, that's a visual language in many ways.
Yeah.
You're reading papers, you're communicating through email.
Yeah.
So in some ways, probably life didn't change all that much.
That's right. For things like email, which was a big part of my life ever since the 1980s, I relied on email because when I was a student, I couldn't afford to use the telephone to call my then girlfriend who was living in the States when I was in Europe at the time. And so email was a big part of our life, and that didn't change. And physicists care mostly not about what you look like or how good your hearing is. They actually care about your ideas. And so as long as you can still communicate and have interesting ideas, then you're relevant to them and they want to talk to you. And so we use the chalkboard and we draw things. So it is very visual, you're right, and that helped a lot. And my colleagues were incredibly understanding and supportive of the situation. And so it was possible to continue to do work and to be recognized for that work. And in fact, that you don't hear means there are less distractions in your life in some ways, so you could focus more on work.
We're talking to physicist Ian Shipsey. Now, when you got this medical treatment that destroyed your hearing, what actually was destroyed?
Yeah, so the way that hearing works is that if you think about something like a tuning fork, you strike a tuning fork, and that the tines of that fork vibrate, and they cause air molecules in the air to vibrate. And then those air molecules knock into other air molecules, and a mechanical vibration of air travels to your ear. When it gets to your ear, it causes your eardrum to go backwards and forwards. And the eardrum is connected to a small bone that goes to the cochlea. And that pushes a fluid. And when that pushes a fluid, it causes little cells to deflect, and they produce electricity. And that electricity passes to the brain, and we hear sound. What antibiotics do is that they can damage those hair cells. And so when they're damaged, they can no longer produce the electricity. And so although a sound is still made, my eardrum goes backwards and forwards, and energy goes into my cochlea, the hair cells are not there anymore. They've gone. And so they can't turn the sound into electricity, and so I can't hear. And that's a very common form of hearing loss, in fact.
And when you get the cochlear implant, it corrects exactly that problem.
Exactly right, exactly right. What it does is it makes the electricity.
Oh, okay. And so you got this cochlear implant 13 years after you lost your hearing.
Yeah, right, that's right.
You
2003, yeah.
You heard your wife for the first time in 13 years.
Yeah.
You heard your daughter's voice for the first time ever.
That's right, yeah.
And what was that like? Was it similar to your hearing before?
Yeah, so when you were... First of all, there's no real words in English language to describe how wonderful it is to hear your daughter for the first time ever.
Yeah.
I remember in that case, what happened was after the surgery for the implant, there's a two-month waiting period before you're completely healed. And at that point, the device can be actually turned on. And you can, in principle, if the device works well, hear for the first time again. So in my case, the operation had been in November. And we were going to go for the holidays back to Europe to see family. And we were told that the day that the device would be turned on would be in January. So we were disappointed because it would mean we wouldn't be able to go home and my family wouldn't be able to see that Ian's got his hearing back. So then, 4 days before we were leaving, we had a phone call to my wife to say that there'd been a cancellation and could I drive from Peru to Indianapolis and have the device turned on. And so I said, you bet. You know, so you got in the car, drive down there, go into a very elaborate audiologist's laboratory where they test the device, get it to tune it up, and then they're about to turn it on. Through this time, you've heard absolutely nothing. And the audiologist says to you, I'm about to turn this device on yet, so just be patient a little longer. But please remember that you've been deaf for 12 or 13 years now, so the chances it will work are very tiny. But if you're very lucky, you'll be able to hear soft sounds, and if you're even lucky, you'll be able to understand what I'm saying to you in just a few minutes. So then she went back to her keyboard. The device is attached to a computer, they're still tuning things, and then suddenly she turned it on. And I said to her, have you turned it on yet? And as I said that, I heard my voice for the first time in 12 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And then that evening, I got home, and my daughter was at school all day, but she was wondering whether her dad was going to be able to hear, and she comes in, and I could hear her. She could say, hi, Dad, and I could actually hear it. And I see my wife again hear her for the first time in 12 years, and her voice had not changed in 12 years, but my daughter, I'd never heard it before. So it was incredibly exciting, but it was as I imagined it. I could watch when she would read in the days when I was deaf, and I could see that she read carefully, with emotion, with expression. And so one of the first things I did to her was gave her a small book to read. I said, read this to me. And it was A Child's Christmas in Wales by Dylan Thomas, a famous short story. And she read this, and it was extremely beautiful to hear that, very emotional. And then we played music as well, and sung and danced and things like that. And it was like a party for a few hours. And then we all went to bed and hoped that the next morning it wasn't all a dream, and we wake up and you can still hear. And so that was it was just wonderful. It was very exciting. And then we went to Europe 2 days later. And so family in Europe discovered that I got my hearing back. And so that's the power of the cochlear implant, is it restores your humanity to some extent. It really puts you in touch with the world again. And it's thanks to things like physics and biomedical engineering and all of the different disciplines in science and technology coming together to produce something that improves the human condition. So it's a wonderful reason to do science.
The kind of physics that you do, is that related to the kind of physics that's in the cochlear implant?
Not directly. The kind of physics I do is really related to trying to understand where the universe came from and how it's going to change, evolve with time, and how it will end. So it's asking a very big question. However, that same discipline, physics, is the reason why we can manipulate electrons in pieces of silicon that enable computers and cell phones and the cochlear implant. And so at some level, the things that we study today could lead to an understanding of the way the world works that could be useful to improve the human condition in the future. And in the past, my predecessors did work that led to such things as the World Wide Web, an understanding of how to build a silicon circuit, and that kind of thing. You know.
Now, how long do these implants last?
That's a good question. Nobody really knows how long they last because they're relatively new, but people expect that in an adult, probably about 30 years or so. They're made of materials that are very safe to put inside a person, ceramics and titanium and things like that. And so they could last a long time, but what will happen is that with time, the developments of the implant are such that you might wish to get an upgrade. Get a replacement, a better one, for example.
Now they don't need to be powered?
Yeah, they do, in fact, batteries. So there's a bunch of batteries. At the moment I'm wearing headphones, so it's hard for you to see, but my cochlear implant has three hearing aid batteries.
So there's one part which is outside your head,
that's
and there's
right.
one part that's inside
exactly.
the head.
Exactly, that's right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so the implant in a sense is a misnomer because half of it's outside. One day, everything will be inside, but that's difficult to do at the moment.
Right.
They need a lot of power to run. The batteries, for example, the same as that are used in a digital hearing aid, there, one battery would last maybe 2 weeks. I use three batteries every day.
Right.
So we're doing a lot of power is being used to analyze the sounds that you're making and then turning them into electricity and passing them to my brain along the auditory nerve. So that requires a lot of power.
Does this cochlear implant work for almost everybody who's deaf?
No, it depends on why you're deaf in the first place. For example, supposing there was something wrong with your eardrum, then that's not what a cochlear implant... you need to fix your eardrum. You don't need a cochlear implant for that.
Right.
So it works for the type of deafness where there's a loss of a large number of these things called hair cells, which turn sound into electricity. In my case, I lost all of them. And so had no hearing left whatsoever. And so the cochlear implant in that case is the obvious choice for someone who is post-lingually deaf.
Now, we're talking to physicist Ian Shipsey about bionic hearing, the science and the experience. That's the talk that he's giving tonight. How is your hearing compared to the way it was before? In other words, do you hear music the same way? Do you hear the subtlety of sound in the same way?
Yeah, that's a good question. It is very different. But, I mean, first of all, mammals, all of us have, all mammals have a great appreciation of music. Music came before language as a way of communicating. And so we have a great ability to memorize music. So, for example, we often notice how easy it is to remember a series of verses of a song because of the music. If we just tried to remember the poem, it would be much harder. And so that effect we can use as people that cannot hear when listening to music. So if a piece of music is played to me now, and it's a piece I'd heard before I was deaf, then what I will hear is pretty much what I heard before I was deaf. If, on the other hand, I've never heard it before, then it will sound quite pleasant, but it probably won't sound anything like it does to you. And that's because the cochlear implant does not give back the same fidelity of hearing that natural hearing does. So it's very, very good for things like conversation. But when it comes to knowing the frequencies of sound, the pitch of sound, it's quite crude at doing so, because it only has typically 8 or 10 electrodes conveying the sound and sorting the sound into low frequencies and high frequencies. Whereas even a piano has 88 and natural hearing has 10,000.
Right.
And so it's much cruder, but you can actually enjoy music with a cochlear implant, but it requires a certain approach.
I suppose it's like you can hear a friend when you're talking on the cell phone, but listening to a symphony over the cell phone isn't going to be the
exactly,
same.
Exactly. It's a bit like that. Exactly. It's a very good analogy, yeah.
Now, after your hearing was restored, did you find yourself having to make new adjustments to your sensory state the way you did on the other end when you had lost your hearing?
Well, less, I think, because now suddenly you feel liberated and reconnected. And so to a large extent, you go back to the way you were before. However, because I didn't really make that many adjustments for being deaf in the first place, and because colleagues accepted me as a deaf person, there weren't huge changes in that sense. What really changed was just the ease of communication. And much easier for the people around me than it was for me, I think. You know, I was doing great already, and I got my hearing back, and that was really nice. But for people that had to live with me, That was a big improvement for them, you know. So I think they thoroughly enjoyed the fact that I could hear again, and I liked it too. It was nice to be able to talk on the phone, for example, with people,
that kind
of thing. Otherwise, it was always email, you know. So it was definitely a quality of life, big step up, but as much for the people around me as it was for me.
And particularly your daughter, who then went on to become an opera singer.
That's right, yeah. Not because her dad got his hearing back, though, but because she was born with an incredible voice. And, of course, I remember when she was born, she let out an incredible scream, which, of course, I couldn't hear because I was deaf. But the doctor who delivered her said, boy, she's got a powerful voice. She might be a singer one day. And he was joking at the time. But then some years later, she discovered a real interest in both classical music and in singing that music. She was lucky enough to be in the town we lived in a wonderful small choir. That exposed her to music. She then went to a music school, for a summer program, did really well there. That was called Interlochen in Michigan. It's a famous music camp.
Yeah.
And then she got a real voice teacher, someone had been a professor and now retired, and she went from that to doing really well. And she's now at Oberlin. She's a senior there, studying vocal performance and really enjoying every minute of it. It's very exciting, and it's a great school to learn music or anything else, Alec.
Now, you'll be talking tonight about cochlear implants and hearing and your work to some extent. It sounds like you didn't get very involved in the deaf community, but I do wonder. I saw an unbelievable documentary years ago, about 14 years ago, called Sound and Fury, which really makes one think about what the implications are for the cochlear implant on the deaf community, which has its own culture and language.
Right. So some years ago, there was a sense in the National Association for the Deaf, back in 1991, deplored the decision taken by the federal government to allow implantation in young children as being unsound scientifically and ethically. However, the efficaciousness of the implants in some cases, in those young children that received a great deal of support and continued to sign in a very supportive environment, continued to use visual cues, and in addition had the cochlear implant, in some cases did very well. And so by 2001 already, the National Association for the Deaf had in fact decided to adopt a new position statement in which they would recognize that the decision to have an implant is a personal decision. It's not for everybody. It can work well in some cases. It doesn't work well in others. But in those cases where it does work well, it enables a person who once could not hear to participate more fully in a world that's dominated by those that can hear. And so, you can meet many people that lead a very full and very satisfying life as members of the deaf community without a cochlear implant as well. And so it's a difficult personal decision. And many people have taken the course to hearing and some have decided not to. And people can be very happy with both of those choices.
Ian Shipsey is a professor of physics. He's a particle physicist from Oxford University. He will be giving a talk tonight titled Bionic Hearing, The Science and the Experience. It's sponsored by the Santa Fe Alliance for Science. It's at 6 o'clock at the O'Keefe Education Annex, which is at 123 Grant Avenue in Santa Fe. Admission is free. There's priority seating for students, but everybody is welcome, and there are usually refreshments at these wonderful events. Ian Shipsey, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. It's great to have met you and great to be in Santa Fe. I'm looking forward to tonight. Thank you.
Excellent.